13. 20 minutes after sending Shimi back south, Susan and Olive came around a sharp bend and found themselves face to face with 3 mounted men in the road. In the late slanting sun, she saw that the one in the middle had a blue coffin tattooed on his hand. It was Reynolds. Susan's heart sank. The one on Reynolds's left, he wore a stained white drover's hat and had a lazily cocked eye, she didn't know. But the one on the right, who looked like a stony-hearted preacher, was Laszlo Reimer. It was Reimer that Reynolds glanced at after smiling at Susan.
Why, Laz and I couldn't even get us a drink to send his late brother, the Chancellor of whatever you want and the Minister of Thank You Very Much, on with a word, Reynolds said. We hadn't hardly hit town before we got persuaded out here. I wasn't going to go, but damn, that old lady's something. Could talk a corpse into giving a blowjob, if you'll pardon the crudity.
I think your aunt may have lost a wheel or two off her cart, though, sighed Delgado.
Your friends are dead, Susan told him. Reynolds paused, shrugged.
Well, now, maybe see and maybe no. Me, I think I've decided to travel on without them even if they ain't. But I might hang around here one more night. This reaping business, I've heard so much about the way folks do it in the Otters. Especially the bonfire part.
The man with the cocked eye laughed phlegmily.
Let us pass, Olive said. This girl has done nothing, and neither have I.
She helped Dearborn escape, Reimer said. Him who murdered your own husband and my brother. I wouldn't call that nothing.
The gods may restore Kimber Reimer in the clearing, Olive said, but the truth is he looted half of this town's treasury, and what he didn't give over to John Farson he kept for himself.
Reimer recoiled as if slapped.
He didn't know I knew. Laszlo, I'd be angry at how little any of you thought of me, except why would I want to be thought of by the likes of you anyway? I knew enough to make me sick. Leave it at that. I know that the man you're sitting beside,
shut up, Reimer muttered, was likely the one who cut your brother's black heart open.
Cy Reynolds was seen that early morning in that wing, so I've been told,
shut up, you cunt,
and so I believe.
Better do as he says, Cy, and hold your tongue, Reynolds said.
Some of the lazy good humor had left his face, Susan thought. He doesn't like people knowing what he did, not even when he's the one on top and what they know can't hurt him. And he's less without Jonas, a lot less. He knows it, too.
Let us pass, Olive said.
No, Si, I can't do that.
I'll help you then, shall I?
Her hand had crept beneath the outrageously large serape during the palaver, and now she brought out a huge and ancient pistola. Its handles of yellowed ivory, its filigreed barrel of old tarnished silver. On top was a brass powder and spark. Olive had no business even drawing the thing. It caught in her serape, and she had to fight it free. She had no business cocking it either, a process that took both thumbs and 2 tries. But the 3 men were utterly flummoxed by the sight of the elderly blunderbuss in her hands, Reynolds as much as the other 2. He sat his horse with his jaw hanging slack. Jonas would have wept.
Get her!
A cracked old voice shrieked from behind the men blocking the road.
What's wrong with you, you stupid culls? Get her!
Reynolds started at that and went for his gun. He was fast, but he had given Olive too much of a head start and was beaten, beaten cold. Even as he cleared leather with the barrel of his revolver, the mayor's widow held the old gun out in both hands and, squinching her eyes shut like a little girl who was forced to eat something nasty, pulled the trigger. The spark flashed, but the damp powder only made a weary floop sound and disappeared in a puff of blue smoke. The ball, big enough to have taken Clay Reynolds's head off from the nose on up had it fired, stayed in the barrel. In the next instant, his own gun roared in his fist. Olive's horse reared, whinnying. Olive went off the gelding head over boots with a black hole in the orange stripe of her serape, the stripe which lay above her heart. Susan heard herself screaming. The sound seemed to come from very far away. She might have gone on for some time, but then she heard the clop of approaching pony hooves from behind the men in the road, and knew, even before the man with the lazy eye moved aside to show her, she knew, and her screams stopped. The galloped-out pony that had brought the witch back to Hambry had been replaced by a fresh one, but it was the same black cart, the same golden cabalistic symbols, the same driver. Rhea sat with the reins in her claws, her head ticking from side to side like the head of a rusty old robot, grinning at Susan without humor, grinning as a corpse grins.
"Hello, my little sweeting," she said, calling her as she had all those months ago, on the night Susan had come to her hut to be proved honest, on the night Susan had come running most of the way out of simple high spirits. Beneath the light of the kissing moon she had come, her blood high from the exercise, her skin flushed. She had been singing careless love. "Your pallies and screw buddies have taken my ball, you can," Rhea said, clucking the pony to a stop a few paces ahead of the riders. Even Reynolds looked down on her with uneasiness. "Took my lovely glam, that's what those bad boys did, those bad, bad boys. But it showed me much while yet I had it, aye. It sees far, and in more ways than one. Much of it I forgot. But not which way ye'd come, my sweeting. Not which way that precious old dead bitch laying yonder on the road would bring ye. And now ye must go to town."
Her grin widened, became something unspeakable.
"It's time for the fair, ye ken."
"Let me go," Susan said. "Let me go if ye had not answer to Roland of Gilead."
Rhea ignored her and spoke to Reynolds.
"Bind her hands before her and stand her in the back of the cart. There's people that'll want to see her. A good look is what they'll want, and a good look is just what they'll have. If her aunt's done a proper job, there'll be a lot of 'em in town. Get her up now and be smart about it."
14. Alain had time for one clear thought. We could have gone around them. If what Roland said is true, then only the wizard's glass matters, and we have that. We could have gone around them. Except, of course, that was impossible. 100 generations of gunslinger blood argued against it. Tower or no tower, the thieves must not be allowed to have their prize, not if they could be stopped. Alain leaned forward and spoke directly into his horse's ear. "Jig or rear when I start shooting and I'll knock your fucking brains out." Roland led them in, outracing the other two on his stronger horse. The clot of men nearest by, 5 or 6 mounted, 12 or more on foot, and examining a pair of the oxen which had dragged the tankers out here, gazed at him stupidly until he began to fire, and then they scattered like quail. He got every one of the riders. Their horses fled in a widening fan, trailing their reins, and in one case a dead soldier. Somewhere someone was shouting, "Harriers! Harriers! Mount up, you fools!" "Alain!" Roland screamed as they bore down. In front of the tankers, a double handful of riders and armed men were coming together, milling together in a clumsy defensive line. "Now! Now!" Alain raised the machine gun, seated its rusty wire stock in the hollow of his shoulder, and remembered what little he knew about rapid-fire weapons. Aim low, swing fast and smooth. He touched the trigger, and the speed shooter bellowed into the dusty air, recoiling against his shoulder in a series of rapid thuds, shooting bright fire from the end of its perforated barrel. Alain raked it from left to right, running the sight above the scattering, shouting defenders and across the high steel hides of the tankers. The third tanker actually blew up on its own. The sound it made was like no explosion Alain had ever heard, a guttural, muscular, ripping sound accompanied by a brilliant flash of orange-red fire. The steel shell rose in 2 halves. One of these spun 30 yards through the air and landed on the desert floor in a furiously burning hulk. The other rose straight up into a column of greasy black smoke. A burning wooden wheel spun across the sky like a plate and came back down trailing sparks and burning splinters. Men fled, screaming, some on foot, others laid flat along the necks of their nags, their eyes wide and panicky. When Alain reached the end of the line of tankers, he reversed the track of the muzzle. The machine gun was hot in his hands now, but he kept his finger pressed to the trigger. In this world, you had to use what you could while it still worked. Beneath him, his horse ran on as if it had understood every word Alain had whispered in its ear. "Another! I want another!" But before he could blow another tanker, the gun ceased its chatter, perhaps jammed, probably empty. Alain threw it aside and drew his revolver. From beside him there came the thump of Cuthbert's slingshot, audible even over the cries of the men, the hoofbeats of the horses, the whoosh of the burning tanker. Alain saw a sputtering big bang arc into the sky and come down exactly where Cuthbert had aimed, in the oil puddling around the wooden wheels of a tanker marked Sunoco. For a moment, Alain could clearly see the line of 9 or 12 holes in the tanker's bright side, holes he had put there with Cy Lengel's speed shooter, and then there was a crack and a flash as the Big Bang exploded. A moment later, the holes running along the bright flank of the tanker began to shimmer. The oil beneath them was on fire. "Get out!" a man in a faded campaign hat yelled. "She's going to blow! They're all going to blow!" Alain shot him, exploding the side of his face and knocking him out of one old sprung boot. A moment later, the second tanker blew up. One burning steel panel shot out sidewards, landed in the growing puddle of crude oil beneath a third tanker, and then that one exploded as well. Black smoke rose in the air like the fumes of a funeral pyre. It darkened the day and drew an oily veil across the sun. XV. All 6 of Farson's chief lieutenants had been carefully described to Roland, to all 14 gunslingers in training, and he recognized the man running for the Remuda at once, George Letigo. Roland could have shot him as he ran, but that, ironically, would have made possible a getaway that was cleaner than he wanted. Instead, he shot the man who ran to meet him. Letigo wheeled on the heels of his boots and stared at Roland with blazing, hate-filled eyes. Then he ran again, hailing another man, shouting for the riders who were huddled together beyond the burning zone. 2 more tankers exploded, whamming at Roland's eardrums with dull iron fists, seeming to suck the air back from his lungs like a riptide. The plan had been for Alain to perforate the tankers and for Cuthbert to then shoot in a steady, arcing stream of big bangers, lighting the spilling oil. The one big banger he actually shot seemed to confirm that the plan had been feasible, but it was the last slingshot work Cuthbert did that day. The ease with which the gunslingers had gotten inside the enemy's perimeter and the confusion which greeted their original charge could have been chalked up to inexperience and exhaustion, but the placing of the tankers had been Letigo's mistake, and his alone. He had drawn them tight without even thinking about it, and now they blew tight, one after another. Once the conflagration began, there was no chance of stopping it. Even before Roland raised his left arm and circled it in the air, signaling for Alain and Cuthbert to break off, the work was done. Letigo's encampment was an oily inferno, and John Farson's plans for a motorized assault were so much black smoke being tattered apart by the fin de año wind. "Ride!" Roland screamed. "Ride, ride, ride!" They spurred west toward Eyebolt Canyon. As they went, Roland felt a single bullet drone past his left ear. It was, so far as he knew, the only shot fired at any of them during the assault on the tankers. 16. Letigo was in an ecstasy of fury, a perfect brain-bursting rage, and that was probably merciful. It kept him from thinking of what the good man would do when he learned of this fiasco. For the time being, all Letigo cared about was catching the men who had ambushed him, if an ambush in desert country was even possible. Men? No, the boys who had done this. Letigo knew who they were, all right. He didn't know how they had gotten out here, but he knew who they were, and their run would stop right here, east of the woods and rising hills. "Hendricks!" he bawled. Hendricks had at least managed to hold his men, 6 of them, all mounted near the Remuda. "Hendricks, to me!"
As Hendricks rode toward him, Letigo spun the other way and saw a huddle of men standing and watching the burning tankers. Their gaping mouths and stupid young sheep faces made him feel like screaming and dancing up and down, but he refused to give in to that. He held a narrow beam of concentration, one aimed directly at the raiders, who must not, under any circumstances, be allowed to escape. "You!" he shouted at the men. One of them turned. The others did not. Letigo strode to them, drawing his pistol as he went. He slapped it into the hand of the man who had turned toward the sound of his voice and pointed at random to one of those who had not. "Shoot that fool!" Dazed, his face that of a man who believes he is dreaming, the soldier raised the pistol and shot the man to whom Letigo had pointed. That unlucky fellow went down in a heap of knees and elbows and twitching hands. The others turned. "Good!" Letigo said, taking his gun back. "Sir," Hendricks cried. "I see them, sir. I have the enemy in clear view." Two more tankers exploded. A few wickering shards of steel flew in their direction. Some of the men ducked. Letigo did not so much as twitch, nor did Hendricks. A good man. Thank God for at least one such in this nightmare. "Shall I hie after them, sir?" "I'll take your men and hie after them myself, Hendricks. Mount those hoss guts before us." He swept an arm at the standing men, whose doltish attention had been diverted from the burning tankers to their dead comrade. "Pull in as many others as you can. Do you have a bugler?" "Yes, sir. Rain, sir." Hendricks looked around, beckoned, and a pimply, scared-looking boy rode forward. A dented bugle on a frayed strap hung askew on the front of his shirt. "Rains," Letigo said, "you're with Hendricks."
"Yes, sir."
"Get as many men as you can, Hendricks, but don't linger over the job. They're headed for that canyon, and I believe someone told me it's a box. If so, we're going to turn it into a shooting gallery."
Hendricks's lips spread in a twisted grin.
"Yes, sir."
Behind them, the tankers continued to explode. 17. Roland glanced back and was astonished by the size of the black, smoky column rising into the air. Ahead, he could clearly see the brush blocking most of the canyon's mouth. And although the wind was blowing the wrong way, he could now hear the maddening mosquito whine of the thinny. He patted the air with his outstretched hands, signaling for Cuthbert and Alain to slow down. While they were both still looking at him, he took off his bandana, whipped it into a rope, and tied it so it would cover his ears. They copied him. It was better than nothing. The gunslingers continued west, their shadows now running out behind them as long as gantries on the desert floor. Looking back, Roland could see two groups of riders streaming in pursuit. Letigo was at the head of the first, Roland thought, and he was deliberately holding his riders back a little so that the two groups could merge and attack together. Good, he thought. The three of them rode toward Eyebolt in a tight line, continuing to hold their own horses in, allowing their pursuers to close the distance. Every now and then, another thud smote the air and shivered through the ground as one of the remaining tankers blew up. Roland was amazed at how easy it had been. Even after the battle with Jonas and Lengel, which should have put the men out here on their mettle, it had been easy. It made him think of a Reaptide long ago, he and Cuthbert, surely no more than 7 years old, running along a line of stuffy guys with sticks, knocking them over one after the other. Bang, bang, bangity, bang. The sound of the thinny was warbling its way into his brain in spite of the bandana over his ears, making his eyes water. Behind him he could hear the whoops and shouts of the pursuing men. It delighted him. Letigo's men had counted the odds, 24 against 3, with many more of their own force riding hard to join the battle, and their peckers were up once more. Roland faced front and pointed Rusher at the slit in the brush marking the entrance to Eyebolt Canyon. 18. Hendricks fell in beside Letigo, breathing hard, cheeks glaring with color.
"Sir, beg to report."
"Then do it.
I have 20 men, and they're perhaps 3 times that number riding hard to join us."
Letigo ignored all of this. His eyes were bright blue flecks of ice. Under his mustache was a small, greedy smile.
"Rodney," he said, speaking Hendricks's first name almost with the caress of a lover.
"Sir?"
"I think they're going in, Rodney."
"Yes. Look, I'm sure of it. 2 more minutes and it'll be too late for them to turn back."
He raised his gun, laid the muzzle across his forearm, and threw a shot at the three riders ahead, mostly in exuberance.
"Yes, sir. Very good, sir."
Hendricks turned and waved viciously for his men to close up. Close up. 19.
"Dismount," Roland shouted when they reached the line of tangled brush. It had a smell that was at once dry and oily, like a fire waiting to happen. He didn't know if their failure to ride their horses into the canyon would put Letigo's wind up or not, and he didn't care. These were good mounts, fine Gilead stock, and over these last months Rusher had become his friend. He would not take him or any of the horses into the canyon, where they would be caught between the fire and the thinny. The boys were off the horses in a flash, Alen pulling the drawstring bag free of his saddle horn and slinging it over one shoulder. Cuthbert's and Alain's horses ran at once, whinnying, parallel to the brush. But Rusher lingered for a moment, looking at Roland.
"Go on," Roland slapped him on the flank.
"Run."
Rusher ran, tails streaming out behind him. Cuthbert and Alain slipped through the break in the brush. Roland followed, glancing down to make sure that the powder trail was still there. It was, and still dry. There had been not a drop of rain since the day they'd laid it.
"Cuthbert," he said, "matches."
Cuthbert gave him some. He was grinning so hard it was a wonder they hadn't fallen out of his mouth.
"We warmed up their day, didn't we, Roland?"
"Aye."
"We did indeed," Roland said, grinning himself.
"Go on now, back to that chimney cut."
"Let me do it," Cuthbert said. "Please, Roland, you go with Alain and let me stay. I'm a firebug at heart, always have been."
"No," Roland said. "This part of it's mine. Don't argue with me, go on. And tell Alain to mind the wizard's glass no matter what." Cuthbert looked at him for a moment longer, then nodded.
"Don't wait too long."
"I won't."
"May your luck rise, Roland."
"May yours rise twice."
Cuthbert hurried away, boots rattling on the loose stone which carpeted the floor of the canyon. He reached Alain, who lifted a hand to Roland. Roland nodded back, then ducked as a bullet snapped close enough to his temple to flick his hat brim. He crouched to the left of the opening in the brush and peered around, the wind now striking full in his face. Letigo's men were closing rapidly, more rapidly than he had expected. If the wind blew out the lucifers... Never mind the ifs. Hold on, Roland. Hold on. Wait for them. He held on, hunkering with an unlit match in each hand, now peering out through a tangle of interlaced branches. The smell of mesquite was strong in his nostrils. Not far behind it was the reek of burning oil. The drone of the thinny filled his head, making him feel dizzy, a stranger to himself. He thought of how it had been inside the pink storm, flying through the air, how he had been snatched away from his vision of Susan. "Thank God for Shimi," he thought distantly. "He'll make sure she finishes the day someplace safe." But the craven whine of the thinny seemed somehow to mock him, to ask him if there had been more to see. Now Letigo and his men were crossing the last 300 yards to the canyon's mouth at a full-out gallop, the ones behind closing up fast. It would be hard for the ones riding point to stop suddenly without the risk of being ridden down. It was time. Roland stuck one of the lucifers between his front teeth and raked it forward. It lit, spilling one hot and sour spark onto the wet bed of his tongue. Before the lucifer's head could burn away, Roland touched it to the powder in the trench. It lit at once, running left beneath the north end of the brush in a bright yellow thread. He lunged across the opening, which might be wide enough for two horses running flank to flank, with the second lucifer already poised behind his teeth. He struck it as soon as he was somewhat blocked from the wind, dropped it into the powder, heard the splutter hiss, then turned and ran. 20. "Mother and father," was Roland's first shocked thought. Memory so deep and unexpected, it was like a slap. At Lake Saroni. When had they gone there? To beautiful Lake Saroni in the northern part of Gilead Barony. That Roland couldn't remember. He knew only that he had been very small, and that there had been a beautiful stretch of sandy beach for him to play on, perfect for an aspiring young castle builder such as he. That was what he had been doing on one day of their vacation. Was it a vacation? Did my parents once upon a time actually take a vacation trip? And he had looked up,
Something, maybe only the cries of the birds circling over the lake, had made him look up. And there were his mother and father, Stephen and Gabrielle Duchesne, at the water's edge, standing with their backs to him and their arms around each other's waists, looking out at blue water beneath a blue summer sky. How his heart had filled with love for them, how infinite was love, twining in and out of hope and memory, like a braid with three strong strands, so much the bright tower of every human's life and soul. It wasn't love he felt now, however, but terror. The figures standing before him as he ran back to where the canyon ended, where the rational part of the canyon ended, weren't Stephen of Gilead and Gabrielle of Arton, but his mollies, Cuthbert and Elen. They didn't have their arms around each other's waists either, but their hands were clasped, like the hands of fairy tale children lost in a threatening fairy tale wood. Birds circled, but they were vultures, not gulls, and the shimmering, mist-topped stuff before the two boys wasn't water. It was the thinny. And as Roland watched, Cuthbert and Alain began to walk toward it. "Stop!" he screamed. "For your father's sake, stop!" They did not stop. They walked hand in hand toward the white-edged hem of the smoky green shimmer. The thinny whined its pleasure, murmured endearments, promised rewards. It baked the nerves numb and picked at the brain. There was no time to reach them, so Roland did the only thing he could think of, raised one of his guns and fired it over their heads. The report was a hammer blow in the canyon's enclosure, and for a moment the ricochet whine was louder than that of the thinny. The two boys stopped only inches from its sick shimmer. Roland kept expecting it to reach out and grab them, as it had grabbed the low-flying bird when they had been here on the night of the peddler's moon. He triggered two more shots into the air, the reports hitting the walls and rolling back. "Gunslingers!" he cried. "To me! To me!" It was Alain who turned toward him first, his dazed eyes seeming to float in his dust-streaked face. Cuthbert continued forward another step, the tips of his boots disappearing in the greenish-silver froth at the edge of the thinny. The whinging grumble of the thing rose half a note, as if in anticipation, and then Alain yanked him back by the tug-string of his sombrero. Cuthbert tripped over a good-sized chunk of fallen rock and landed hard. When he looked up, his eyes had cleared. "Gods!" he murmured, and as he scrambled to his feet, Roland saw that the toes of his boots were gone, clipped off neatly as if with a pair of gardening shears. His great toes stuck out. "Roland!" he gasped as he and Alain stumbled toward him. "Roland! We were almost gone! It talks!" "Yes, I've heard it. Come on, there's no time." He led them to the notch in the canyon wall, praying that they could get up quick enough to avoid being riddled with bullets, as they certainly would be if Letigo arrived before they could get up at least part of the way. A smell, acrid and bitter, began to fill the air, an odor like boiling juniper berries, and the first tendrils of whitish-gray smoke drifted past them. "Cuthbert, you first. Alain, you next. I'll come last. Climb fast, boys. Climb for your lives." Letigo's men poured through the slot in the wall of brush like water pouring into a funnel, gradually widening the gap as they came. The bottom layer of the dead vegetation was already on fire, but in their excitement none of them saw those first low flames, or marked them if they did. The pungent smoke also went unnoticed. Their noses had been deadened by the colossal stench of the burning oil. Letigo himself, in the lead, with Hendricks close behind, had only one thought. Two words that pounded at his brain in a kind of vicious triumph. Box Canyon! Box Canyon! Box Canyon! Yet something began to intrude on this mantra as he galloped deeper into Eyebolt, his horse's hooves clattering nimbly through the scree of rocks and bones, whitish piles of cow skulls and rib cages. This was a kind of low buzzing, a maddening, slobbering whine, insectile and insistent. It made his eyes water. Yet strong as the sound was, if it was a sound, it almost seemed to be coming from inside him, he pushed it aside, holding onto his mantra, "Box Canyon, Box Canyon," got him in a Box Canyon instead.
He would have to face Walter when this was over, perhaps Farson himself, and he had no idea what his punishment would be for losing the tankers, but all that was for later. Now he wanted only to kill these interfering bastards. Up ahead, the canyon took a jog to the north. They would be beyond that point, and probably not far beyond either, backed up against the canyon's final wall, trying to squeeze themselves behind what fallen rocks there might be. Letigo would mass what guns he had and drive them out into the open with ricochets. They would probably come with their hands up, hoping for mercy. They would hope in vain. After what they'd done, the trouble they'd caused, as Letigo rode around the jog in the canyon's wall, already leveling his pistol, his horse screamed, like a woman it screamed, and reared beneath him. Letigo caught the saddle horn and managed to stay up, but the horse's rear hooves slid sideways in the scree, and the animal went down. Letigo let go of the horn and threw himself clear, already aware that the sound which had been creeping into his ears was suddenly 10 times stronger, buzzing, loud enough to make his eyeballs pulse in their sockets, loud enough to make his balls tingle unpleasantly, loud enough to blot out the mantra which had been beating so insistently in his head. The insistence of the finny was far, far greater than any George Letigo could have managed. Horses flashed around him as he landed in a kind of sprawling squat, horses that were shoved forward willy-nilly by the oncoming press from behind, by riders that squeezed through the gap in pairs, then trios as the hole in the brush, now burning all along its length, widened, and then spread out again once they were past the bottleneck, none of them clearly realizing that the entire canyon was a bottleneck. Letigo got a confused glimpse of black tails and gray forelegs and dappled fetlocks. He saw chaps and jeans and boots jammed into stirrups. He tried to get up, and a horseshoe clanged against the back of his skull. His hat saved him from unconsciousness, but he went heavily to his knees with his head down, like a man who means to pray, his vision full of stars, and the back of his neck instantly soaked with blood from the gash the passing hoof had opened in his scalp. Now he heard more screaming horses, screaming men as well. He got up again, coughing out the dust raised by the passing horses, such acrid dust, too, it clawed his throat like smoke, and saw Hendricks trying to spur his horse south and east against the oncoming tide of riders. He couldn't do it. The rear third of the canyon was some sort of swamp, filled with greenish, steaming water, and there must be quicksand beneath it because Hendricks's horse seemed stuck. It screamed again and tried to rear. Its hindquarters slewed sideways. Hendricks crashed his boots into the animal's sides again and again, attempting to get it in motion, but the horse didn't, or couldn't, move. That hungry buzzing sound filled Letigo's ears and seemed to fill the world. "Back! Turn back!" He tried to scream the words, but they came out in what was little more than a croak. Still the riders pounded past him, raising dust that was too thick to be only dust. Letigo pulled in breath so he could scream louder. They had to go back. Something was dreadfully wrong in Eyebolt Canyon, and hacked it out without saying anything. Screaming horses, reeking smoke, and everywhere filling the world like lunacy, that whining, whinging, cringing buzz. Hendricks's horse went down, eyes rolling, bit-parted teeth snapping at the smoky air and splattering curds of foam from its lips. Hendricks fell into the steaming, stagnant water, and it wasn't water at all. It came alive somehow as he struck it, grew green hands and a green, shifty mouth, pawed his cheek and melted away the flesh, pawed his nose and tore it off, pawed at his eyes and stripped them from their sockets. It pulled Hendricks under, but before it did, Letigo saw his denuded jawbone, a bloody piston to drive his screaming teeth. Other men saw and tried to wheel away from the green trap. Those who managed to do so in time were broadsided by the next wave of men, some of whom were, incredibly, still yipping or bellowing full-throated battle cries. More horses and riders were driven into the green shimmer, which accepted them eagerly. Letigo, standing stunned and bleeding like a man in the middle of a stampede, which was exactly what he was, saw the soldier to whom he had given his gun. This fellow, who had obeyed Letigo's order and shot one of his compadres in order to awaken the rest of them, threw himself from his saddle, howling, and crawled back from the edge of the green stuff even as his horse plunged in. He tried to get to his feet, saw two riders bearing down on him, and clapped his hands across his face. A moment later, he was ridden down. The shrieks of the wounded and dying echoed in the smoky canyon, but Letigo hardly heard them. What he heard mostly was that buzzing, a sound that was almost a voice, inviting him to jump in, to end it here. Why not? It was over, wasn't it? All over. He struggled away instead, and was now able to make some headway. The stream of riders packing its way into the canyon was easing. Some of the riders 50 or 60 yards back from the jog had even been able to turn their horses. But these were ghostly and confused in the thickening smoke. "The cunning bastards have set the brush on fire behind us! Gods of heaven, gods of earth, I think we're trapped in here!" He could give no commands. Every time he drew in breath to try, he coughed it wordlessly back out again. But he was able to grab a passing rider who looked all of 17 and yank him out of his saddle. The boy went down head first and smashed his brow open on a jutting chunk of rock. Letigo was mounted in his place before the kid's feet had stopped twitching. He jerked the horse's head around and spurred for the front of the canyon, but the smoke thickened to a choking white cloud before he got more than 20 yards. The wind was driving it this way. Letigo could make out barely the shifting orange glare of the burning brush at the desert end. He wheeled his new horse back the way it had come. More horses loomed out of the fog. Letigo crashed into one of them and was thrown for the second time in 5 minutes. He landed on his knees, scrambled to his feet, and staggered back downwind, coughing and retching, eyes red and streaming. It was a little better beyond the canyon's northward jog, but wouldn't be for much longer. The edge of the thinny was a tangle of milling horses, many with broken legs, and crawling, shrieking men. Letigo saw several hats floating on the greenish surface of the whining organism that filled the back of the canyon. He saw boots, he saw wristlets, he saw neckerchiefs, he saw the bugle boy's dented instrument still trailing its frayed strap. "Come in," the green shimmer invited, and Letigo found its buzz strangely attractive, intimate, almost. "Come in and visit. Squat and hunker. Be at rest. Be at peace. Be at one." Letigo raised his gun, meaning to shoot it. He didn't believe it could be killed, but he would remember the face of his father and go down shooting all the same. Except he didn't. The gun dropped from his relaxing fingers, and he walked forward. Others around him were now doing the same, into the thinny. The buzzing rose and rose, filling his ears until there was nothing else. Nothing else at all. XXII. They saw it all from the notch, where Roland and his friends had stopped in a strung-out line about 20 feet below the top. They saw the screaming confusion, the panicky milling, the men who were trampled, the men and horses that were driven into the thinny, and the men who, at the end, walked willingly into it. Cuthbert was closest to the top of the canyon's wall, then Elaine, then Roland, standing on a 6-inch shelf of rock and holding an outcrop just above him. From their vantage point, they could see what the men struggling in their smoky hell below them could not. That the thinny was growing, reaching out, crawling eagerly toward them like an incoming tide. Roland, his battle lust slaked, did not want to watch what was happening below. But he couldn't turn away. The whine of the thinny, cowardly and triumphant at the same time, happy and sad at the same time, lost and found at the same time, held him like sweet, sticky ropes. He hung where he was, hypnotized, as did his friends above him, even when the smoke began to rise and its pungent tang made him cough dryly. Men shrieked their lives away in the thickening smoke below. They struggled in it like phantoms. They faded as the fog thickened, climbing the canyon walls like water. Horses whinnied desperately from beneath that acrid white death. The wind swirled its surface in prankish whirlpools, the thinny buzzed, and above where it lay the surface of the smoke was stained a mystic shade of palest green. Then, at long last, John Farson's men screamed no more. "We killed them,"
Roland thought with a kind of sick and fascinated horror. Then, no, not we. I killed them. How long he might have stayed there, Roland didn't know. Perhaps until the rising smoke engulfed him as well. But then Cuthbert, who had begun to climb again, called down three words from above him, called down in a tone of surprise and dismay.
Roland! The moon!
Roland looked up, startled, and saw that the sky had darkened to a velvety purple. His friend was outlined against it and looking east, his face stained fever orange with the light of the rising moon.
Yes, orange, the thinny buzzed inside his head, laughed inside his head. Orange as 'twas when it rose on the night you came out here to see me and count me. Orange like a fire, orange like a bonfire.
How can it be almost dark? He cried inside himself, but he knew. Yes, he knew very well. Time had slipped back together. That was all like layers of ground embracing once more after the argument of an earthquake. Twilight had come. Moonrise had come. Terror struck Roland like a closed fist aimed at the heart, making him jerk backward on the small ledge he'd found. He groped for the horn-shaped outcrop above him, but that act of rebalancing was far away. Most of him was inside the pink storm again, before he had been snatched away and shown half the cosmos. Perhaps the wizard's glass had only shown him what stood worlds far away in order to keep from showing him what might soon befall so close to home. I'd turn around if I thought her life was in any real danger, he had said, in a second. And if the ball knew that? If it couldn't lie, might it not misdirect? Might it not take him away and show him a dark land, a darker tower? And it had shown him something else, something that recurred to him only now, a scrawny man in farmer's overalls who had said, what? Not quite what he'd thought, not what he had been used to hearing all his life, not life for you and life for your crop, but death, he whispered to the stones surrounding him. Death for you, life for my crop. Char you tree. That's what he said. Char you tree. Come reap.
Orange, gunslinger.
A cracked old voice laughed inside his head. The voice of the coos.
The color of bonfires. Char you tree. Fiend on you. These are the old ways of which only the stuffy guys with their red hands remain. Until tonight. Tonight the old ways are refreshed, as the old ways must be from time to time. Char you tree, you damned babby, char you tree! Tonight you pay for my sweet ermot, tonight you pay for all. Come, reap!
Climb! He screamed, reaching up and slapping Alain's behind. Climb, climb, for your father's sake, climb! Roland, what... Alain's voice was dazed, but he did begin to climb, going from handhold to handhold and rattling small pebbles down into Roland's upturned face. Squinting against their fall, Roland reached and swatted Al's bottom again, driving him like a horse. "Climb, goddamn you!" he cried. "It mayn't be too late, even now!" But he knew better. Demon moon had risen. He had seen its orange light shining on Cuthbert's face like delirium, and he knew better. In his head, the lunatic buzz of the thinny, that rotting sore eating through the flesh of reality, joined with the lunatic laughter of the witch, and he knew better. Death for you, life for the crop, char you tree.
Oh, Susan.